You're hearing voices.
Could a 26-year-old burn nurse be interested in her 14-year-old patient? I was in love with Tina, and I was sure that she was at least a little bit in love with me, too.
This is Visiting Hours, an hour of bedside stories from Hearing Voices and NPR.
But for both of us, it's better that we ignore the gray institutional tile floors, the pills and the medicine cups, and instead fill the room with pictures of her and her seven sisters.
Hospitals, IVs, bedpans, pills, and long goodbyes. Stories from Nancy Updike, Brian Brophy, Carmen Delzell, Brent Runyon, and myself, Seal Muller.
This is the life-changing lesson hospitals have to offer. TV is good for you.
This is unbelievable. Imagine people before used to lay in hospital beds for days and weeks on end.
It's just about time for Visiting Hours from HearingVoices.com. Everyone loves a good funeral. First you cry, then you party. And this is a funeral, New Orleans style. Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio from NPR, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Seal Muller from public radio station KQED in San Francisco, and I'll be your host today. You might want to grab a box of tissues, because today on Visiting Hours, not everyone gets to make it home okay. Later in the program, we'll attend an Irish wake. We'll also stop in at a burn unit, visit a grandma in the hospital, and we'll pay homage to that ubiquitous caregiver, the television. We'll start with a few tips you might find useful. I wrote them after my own husband, Alvar Stugar, died on the 2nd of September, 2000. The kissing. His tongue darting into my mouth. Maybe that was the most important. With so little time left, every moment is memorable and questionable. His mouth might have been the most antiseptic place in that hospital. Certainly, it was the most welcoming, greedily reaching out for every possible life-giving experience he could get. Death was not without pride. It was just greedy. In the end, Alvy did die. So what follows is an etiquette list for those who may be dying soon. Keep it handy, because, as everyone keeps telling me, people die, you know. We all die. That, by the way, may be tip number one for those who want to offer condolences. Reminding the survivor that we all die is not a comfort. Maybe this should be a list for survivors. Okay, tip number two. When attempting to climb into the hospital bed and it starts to creak and you start thinking about how expensive they are and you start to worry about breaking the damn thing, just do it. There will never be another place to hold each other again. When designing those beds, someone should think about that. Never mind the bed. Hospitals are not places to get rest. The staff is there to work around the clock. Blood technicians will wake you at 6 a.m. So what if you only got to sleep at 3 a.m. because they decided to move you to another room in the middle of the night? We need to do this now, you will be told. The doctors need the results for their morning rounds. Sometimes, mysteriously, they will wake you just to weigh you. Because you are basically dying, you will not have the strength to fight them off. If possible, do not enter the hospital when you know your time is almost up. However, your wife and loved ones will probably insist. They can't stop hoping. After all, they are still part of the world of the living. Continued belief in the practice of medicine could be considered irrational at this point. Everyone gets a little crazy when time is running out. When I brought Alvy to the emergency room the final time, he was pissed. No, I don't want to go back to the hospital, he kept saying. But in my panic, I prevailed. Once there, the young doctor starts to ask the usual questions. And as usual, she shouts, "Do you know where you are? Do you know what year it is?" Avi looks up and says, "I'm sick, not deaf." This may be tip number 3. Remind the personnel that you are a human being whenever possible. Do you know why you're here? She shouts again. Albie looks over at me and answers. Yeah, she got scared.
Oh, when we came in?
And then he answered the questions correctly. I'm in the hospital. It's August 2000. But an hour later, his answer changed. It's 1998. We were starting to lose time. Tip 4. This is a combo tip for both survivors and the dying. If you see the Transamerica building out the hospital window at 2 a.m. and Alvy says, look, there's the Eiffel Tower, just go with it. That trip to France you never took together, well, this is probably going to be as close as you'll ever get.
Quand tout vous changez d'âge, tout offre un long voyage.
You should get your affairs in order. That's what doctors always say on television. In real life, they never say this. But when Dr. Z told me Alvy would not get a liver transplant because too many 20-year-olds with genetic problems needed them more, he also said medicine is not a science. It is an unperfected art. Well, then, perhaps there would be a miracle. When words start to fail, you may be tempted to sing. Be careful what music you choose. You may never be able to listen to it again.
Pack up all your dishes. Make note of all.
I chose an old Guy Clark song, one that had been with us since we met in 1982. Albie had recorded it for a film he had worked on called Heartworn Highways. And me? I just always loved that tune. Someday, we were going to get out of the city.
I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed. Come, I'll be down the road in a cloud of smoke to some land. I ain't bought any.
The miracle we'd been hoping for arrives the next morning. The blood work comes back, showing the ammonia levels have dropped from 135 to 40. Normal is 25. Alvy's mind clears. Dr. Z talks directly to him, asking if he wants some aggressive treatment. This doctor respects his patient as a human being. It is, after all, Alvy's life, and he gets to make the decisions. Later, I'm told it's mostly to make him comfortable. Alvy will be transferred to a skilled nursing facility. Turns out that just means nursing home. And no more life-saving treatment will be offered. He will either get better on his own, or he won't. Go figure. One last suggestion. Pay attention to what's being said between the lines. When someone asks, do you want me to die? They're probably not asking, do you want to get rid of me? But when they ask, do you want me to go now? You have to start realizing that they are dying. If you are the one asking the question, then you know more than the living. You are starting to cross over. When I realized what Alvy was really saying, I was sitting outside next to a star jasmine plant. I should have taken him outside to smell it. But I told him, yes, you are very ill, and no, I don't want you to die. Still, if you have to go, I'll be okay, and I'll see you sometime later. At the moment, I believe that. Now I'm back home, trapped in the bondage of time and space. But someday I too won't be. Maybe then. Who knows? Months later, I dream Alvy tells me he's got to go now, to a planet called Thessalus. The people there need him. I'm not quite sure where it's located. Probably out by the star cluster known as M30. That's my best guess. But then again, who knows? One thing I do know is Alvar would have loved this jazz funeral. This is Visiting Hours from Hearing Voices. And we're back in the hospital with Brent Runyon, reading an excerpt from his memoir, The Burn Journals. He was 14 years old at the time. An unsuccessful suicide attempt had put him in the burn unit, but there was one nurse who gave him hope.
During the first weeks in the burn unit, pain blared from my wounds like air horns at a high school football game. I hated my body, my nerves, my brain. I wanted them all to just shut up. There were only a few times I wasn't in pain. Once before burn therapy, Tina, my nurse, pushed morphine straight into my bloodstream instead of dripping it through the IV. I asked her to push it. I begged her to let me feel it all at once, to blow out my mind like an overexposed photograph, and she did. For 30 seconds, I couldn't feel my body. My vision was whitewashed, and I understood why someone would want to be an addict. When I could talk again, I mumbled, "Why don't they sell this stuff on the streets? They could make a fortune." Tina unwrapped my bandages, exposing my legs to the air. I looked down. They didn't look like legs at all. They were skinny and useless, so many shades of purple they didn't even look real. I saw the massive wound as big as a mailbox on my left thigh, where the fire had burned all the way through to the muscle. Tina saw me looking, leaned over and whispered what she always said. "It's okay. It's going to get better. The redness means that it's healing." I closed my eyes and braced myself for what was coming next. She would begin by cleaning each open wound on my feet, working up to my thighs, and then she would turn me on my stomach to clean the holes in my back. The pain roared from my legs as she cleaned the first wound. Tina explained that my body was healing, and that healing was one of the most painful things a body could do. She said that pain meant I was getting better. It didn't feel like I was getting better. My skin was tissue paper, and she was tearing at it with steel wool. She told me that if it hurt too much that I should scream as loud as I could, and at first I didn't want to. I thought it would be rude or disruptive, and that I could just close my mind to the pain if I tried. But she said that I should scream, and that would let some of the pain out. And so she cleaned every wound 3 times. I screamed, and it became a kind of waltz, with Tina counting her swipes aloud, and me screaming, 1, 2, 3, scream. 1, 2, 3, scream. After she covered me in gauze and ace bandages, my body was shivering. I was exhausted, crying a little bit, trying not to think about how I'd have to do it all over again in 8 hours. Tina stood at the head of my bed. Her thick black curls spiraled toward my face. "Brent," she said, "do you like ice cream?" It seemed like a silly question since I was still getting fed through a tube in my nose. "When you get that nose tube out, when you can walk again, I'm going to take you to the best ice cream shop in D.C. It had been weeks since I had eaten anything, and I hadn't even thought about ice cream. I couldn't believe it. Tina and I would go out for ice cream when I could walk. We would go on a date. It was 8 weeks later, and it was going to be my first time outside the burn unit. Most of the pain had gone and been replaced by the itch. Anyone who's ever had a burn can tell you that the itch comes after the pain, and that it's sometimes worse because it's constant. It made me feel like the skin on my body didn't belong to me, as if it had been stripped away in my sleep and replaced with raw wool. I prepared for hours for my date with Tina. My mom and another nurse named Barbara picked out the loosest, least irritating clothing, and they helped me into a pair of baggy athletic pants and a Hard Rock Cafe London t-shirt that my mom said looked really cool. They discussed whether I should wear the pressure bandage that masked part of my face, and then Barbara slipped the chin strap over my head and Velcroed it behind my neck. She put a purple Los Angeles Lakers cap on me to cover part of the bandage. They both said that I looked handsome. I didn't look in a mirror. Finally, Tina came to pick me up for our date. She had taken off her scrubs and put on a loose white sweater. Her functional shoes were replaced with green All-Stars, and she was wearing shorts. I'd never seen her in shorts before. She looked so relaxed, not like a nurse at all. She smiled at me from the doorway. As a burn nurse in a children's hospital, Tina rarely had patients that she could talk to. Most of the kids she took care of were 2-year-olds, kids that could walk well enough to pull boiling water down from the stove, but couldn't understand that it wasn't her fault that they were in pain. Those kids hated her for hurting them. They panicked every time she came near them. But I knew that the pain wasn't her fault. I talked to her, and we made each other laugh. Could a 26-year-old burn nurse be interested in her 14-year-old patient? I was in love with Tina, and I was sure that she was at least a little bit in love with me, too. Why else would she take me out on a date? And she had called it a date. Why else would she wear shorts or green shoes? A clear sign to a 14-year-old boy that says, go, go, go. We waited for the elevator next to a hospital directory sign, and I decided to make my first joke. I cleared my throat and said, spina bifida. That sounds like some sort of Greek food. Tina made a face and said, you wouldn't say that if you knew what it was. The elevator doors opened. Walking out of the hospital with Tina made me feel like I was on a real date, although I'd never been on a date before. Something about being on my own feet, walking into the fresh air, the afternoon sunlight, a woman next to me. A woman who had, I reminded myself, already seen me naked. But by the time we got to the car, I was exhausted. Sweating from the few remaining pores in my forehead and armpits, the itch which had been mercifully quiet during the first few minutes of our date started buzzing in my legs. Tina must have noticed that I was uncomfortable, because she put the back of her hand, no rubber glove, her actual hand against my forehead, and wiped the beating sweat away. What did that mean, I wondered to myself. Tina parked about a block away from the ice cream place she'd been telling me about, got out of the car and rushed around to my side to open the door. That's sweet, I thought. I wish I'd done that for her. She helped me onto my feet, and we began walking towards the ice cream place. You okay? She asked. Sure, I said. You? I was trying to ignore the itch that had spread up my legs and into my back. I was walking. That was the important thing. And I was on a date. Inside, the cool air dried the sweat on my forehead, and I began to feel more confident. I let out a sigh of relief just to let her know that the worst was over, and that we would start to have fun any second. We stood in line behind a few senior citizens that were deciding between pistachio and butter pecan. I smiled at her and rolled my eyes a little as if to say, can you believe these old people? They're so slow. And she smiled back. This is working, I thought. This is really working. It was then that I saw the ice cream guy checking Tina out from behind the counter. He was college-aged, handsome. I knew what he was thinking. We stepped up to the counter and I prepared myself for the flirting. And then he looked at me, and his smile dropped into an expression of mock pain as he said, ouch, what happened to you? As soon as he said it, I felt the blood pool in my legs and the itch throb all over my body. I backed up a little, stepped away from the counter. I looked down at my feet. I put my hands in my pockets. I didn't want to talk to him anymore. I didn't want to say anything. Tina finally broke the spell and asked me what kind of ice cream I wanted. It was all I could do to mumble, chocolate. My head still cast downward, studying the tile patterns, I asked her if we could eat it in the car on the way back to the hospital, and she said that we could. On the way home, I reached up and touched the long purple scar on my cheek. I pinched the edge and blanched it white between my fingers. The scar was numb on my cheek, lifeless and hard, like a wad of gum under a school desk. Thanks to Ice Cream Guy, I realized that redness didn't mean I was healing anymore. It meant that I was disfigured. I understood that I wasn't going to get much better. Despite all the reassuring things Tina had said to me in the burn unit, this was it. Ice Cream Boy saw me for what I was. Scarred. All I wanted then was to go back to the hospital. I wanted to climb into my mechanical bed and watch Regis and Kathy Lee for the rest of my life. I wanted to eat chalky pudding and flirt with the nurses. I wanted to be able to scream. When we got back to the hospital, Tina walked me to the elevator, and we rode up to the third floor. We hadn't said anything on the ride back. She never asked me how I liked the ice cream, which is good because I wouldn't have known what to say. Right before the doors opened, she put her hand on my forehead. I looked at her, and she said, "Good night, beautiful." And I walked back to the burn unit, the safest place in the world.
Fire and Ice Cream by Brent Runyon was produced by Jay Allison, part of his Life Stories series with help from Christina Egloff.
My grandmother broke her hip. It's fairly common, the young doctor assures me over the telephone. After all, she's 89 years old this month. They will replace the joint with an artificial one, so she can be up on a walker within a week or two. I'm the favorite granddaughter, and so I drive the 100 miles I have driven so many times out Highway 66, west towards the silhouette of the Blue Ridge, where they sell apple cider, pumpkins, and bushels of still delicious last of summer peaches. And I find her, as I always do, in her homemade cotton nightgown that she saves for special occasions, reading a Baptist newsletter. Her pretty white hair is all fluffed out, and someone has put a little pink lipstick on her. She says she's fine, really fine, except for some, what do you call them? Hallucinations? Some little boys come in here, she says. I knew they weren't real, but I let them stay. One of them was singing a hymn, and the other one was playing a little fiddle kind of thing. But when I heard the nurse coming, I told them they'd better go away, and they did. She tells me this story as calmly as she has told me all the other amazing stories over the years. Like the time she and her older sister Alice churned cream all day long on the porch while her mama was having Uncle Richard in the house. 7 pounds of butter we made that day. Mama says she never heard of anyone getting 7 pounds of butter out of one churning. I guess we just want something to keep our minds off of her yelling in the house. She's a real period piece, my grandmother. Born to a sharecropper in North Carolina and put to picking cotton before she was 12. She once picked 100 pounds, more than any of the men could pick, and gave the 50 cents she earned for it to her papa. She's a good storyteller, better than any of us, and I'm a good listener. But for both of us, it's better that we ignore the gray institutional tile floors, the pills and the medicine cups, the staring irrelevant television, and instead fill the room with pictures of her and her 7 sisters breaking watermelon on a rock by the creek and eating it with their bare hands after a long, hot morning working in the fields. Now, don't you worry about me, honey, she always says. I've had a good life. You just take care of them children. So on our way home, my son and I have red beans, coleslaw, and sliced tomatoes at a silver diner outside of Warrenton. It wasn't as good as the Sunday evening leftovers she used to give me when we lived in that big white house on 38th Street, but it kept her memory with us for a few extra miles.
Carmen Delzell's remembrance of her grandmother. You're listening to Hearing Voices, the Visiting Hours edition. Coming up, please do not adjust your TV sets. It's couch potato healing and an Irish life well lived.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Visiting Hours from Hearing Voices. I'm Seal Muller from public radio station KQED in San Francisco, and I'm your host today.
No sign of macular degeneration or optic neuritis. Her eyes are completely normal.
But you can't see out of them.
So she says. Find anything on the MRI?
No sign of plaques. It's not a mess.
We haven't found anything abnormal on any test.
Except she can't see or move her hands.
So she says.
You can't lie about flaccid paralysis.
Oh, if not for the medical shows on TV, some of us would never get to see the inside of a hospital.
This hospital means a lot to you, and you to it. Help me make St. Allegius better. All that means is adapting your point of view.
Dr. Geiger, report to OR stat. Dr. Geiger to OR 3.
Hi, Starman. Come with me.
For those on the inside, television is the ubiquitous 24-hour comfort giver. Nancy Updike found out that even at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, TV holds center stage.
This is how a lot of people feel about watching television in the hospital.
I should be a much better person, and I should try to improve my mind while I'm here. But I just don't have the patience for it, so I slip in to the degradation of this crap television.
I would like to think that I'm the kind of person that could just turn it off and that it wouldn't affect me.
You know, this is what alcoholics say. Oh, I could quit any time.
But when I think about it, if I couldn't watch TV, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I think that maybe I would go a little nuts, you know.
These are two of the patients I talked to at Cedars-Sinai. The guy is Jay Mason, a 74-year-old with a nasty scar running from just under his Adam's apple all the way down his chest. He's had a lot of heart surgery. The woman is LaShawn Smith, who's been lying in the same uncomfortable position for almost a month. She's 31 and having her first baby, and she has to stay in bed with her whole body angled head downwards so that her water doesn't break too soon. She'll stay in that position until the baby's born. She has 3 months to go. And to begin our discussion, let's start here, in this very hospital. So, okay, even if you've never actually been a patient in a hospital, you kind of already know what it's like, right?
There is no such thing as privacy.
You know, people going in and out of your room, looking at you and peeking at you, wondering what's wrong with you.
Taking your temperature, taking blood.
They wake me up early to do vital signs and stuff, and I try to go back to sleep. I mean, we're talking like 5:30.
The day goes very, very, very laboriously.
You know, having people to have to do everything for you and not being able to do things for yourself.
You live for the day you get out of here.
So let's summarize. You're sick, you're lonely, but also completely without privacy. You're exhausted, helpless, and you are so, so, so bored. The culture of the hospital is divided into one group of people that is rushing around from the moment they walk in the door in the morning until the second they leave at night, and another group that is just languishing, numb. And you and I are probably going to be in that second group, right? So we comfort ourselves, and we're not too choosy about how.
7 o'clock in the morning, watch the news, then I'm going to watch Sally Jesse.
Ricky. I just watch crap here. I like anything, a cooking show.
Steve Harvey, Moesha, the Parkers, Malcolm and Eddie. I love seeing black people on televisions.
Channel 2, Young and the Restless. And then Channel 7, All My Children. Then Channel 4, Days of Our Lives.
So you're just as bad as Tasha here. You slept with your best friend's man.
It's almost as provocative in America to say that television has therapeutic value as it is to say that smoking pot does. We associate both with wayward teenagers, wasting their lives and rotting their brains, engaging in insidious activities like hanging out and chilling. But TV is so important to the patients at Cedars-Sinai that the woman who runs the video department there has been paged at home on weekends and at night by irate patients complaining about missing a ball game or a movie because of some technical problem or programming change. One patient I talked to had even been so desperate to amuse herself that she hunkered down one day and became the world's leading expert on
Weekend at Bernie's. I think I saw like 4 times on Saturday because I couldn't find anything else on that I wanted to watch.
Talk about making lemonade from lemons. What is this except the mind tenderly saying to the body, listen, don't you worry about me for a while. I'll take care of myself. You just focus on getting better. This is the life-changing lesson hospitals have to offer. TV is good for you.
This is unbelievable. You imagine people before used to lay in hospital beds for days and weeks on end and just stared at this wall and sometimes turned their heads sideways and looked at that wall? That's horrendous. But, my God, you've got to, you know, you can turn loose a little bit of fantasy, and if it's junk, what the hell's the difference? It's junk, so who cares? At least it's killing time.
I guess I'm sort of arguing that in that sense it's not junk.
Well, I think that you're right. In that sense, it is not junk. It fills my lonely hours and kind of gets me through the day. And that's a good thing.
Outside the hospital, people call TV crap because it's an anesthetic. Watching hours and hours of TV makes us feel spoiled, self-indulgent, numb. But so what? I mean, think about it. Novocaine and morphine make you feel numb, too. And no one's calling them crap.
You're listening to Visiting Hours from Hearing Voices.
What's your favorite color? What's your favorite taste? What's your favorite time of day? How's your relationship with your family? When was the last time you had a rollicking, good, wonderful belly laugh? How do you feel about going to funerals? When you get really, really angry, what does that look like? Do you cry often? What was your favorite food as a child? Are you going on vacation? Have you ever? Are you comfortable getting undressed? Is this your first visit to an acupuncturist?
Questions asked by acupuncturist Beth Burkhart. The piece was produced by Larry Massett. This is Hearing Voices. Visiting hours are almost over, but we still have time for a remembrance from Brian Brophy of his father.
My mother has been in the hospital with my father for the last month, day and night, in a recliner, watching him, trying to help him in whatever way that she could. I found out last month that the cancer had spread into his lower back, and it had infiltrated into his lungs. When I saw him, I was very surprised because he had lost all of his hair and he was about 40 pounds lighter, and you could see the tumors underneath his skin because they had gotten so big. And he was in a bed, and he couldn't talk. He could barely recognize me or my sister.
You have reached the St. Vincent Hospital Pastoral Care Department. We are currently unavailable to come to the phone. Please leave your name, telephone number, and a short message after the beep. We will return your call as soon as possible. If you need a chaplain now, please call the hospital switchboard at 657-7000 and ask to have a chaplain paged. Thank you.
The best thing, the most helpful thing you or I can do to help our family grieve our loss is to share a personal thought today.
I wanted my father to know how much I loved him. I wanted my father to know how much I loved him. And he knew that. He knows how much I love him. I came back to be with him because he helped me throughout all my life, and I thought that was the least that I could do for him, being the oldest boy, to come back and be with him and help him and do whatever he needed for me to do. Unfortunately, that was not very much. I couldn't really do anything. My mother is frustrated because he's beyond the point of being looked after by anybody who doesn't know what they're doing. You need a professional. You need a nurse in there to do what he needs right now.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I don't think a lot of people actually understand sometimes, usually in a death and dying process, that it's almost like the intimacy of literally spending the rest of somebody's life with him. I mean, other people have to do it for 60 or 70 years, and what we experience can happen over 3 weeks to 3 months, 3 days. I don't have to be the person diagnosed with cancer to recognize the value of every single day.
At one time last month, when he was conscious, early part of December of 89, he was conscious and lucid, but very emotional. And I looked at him and I started to stroke his forehead really gently. And he said, "Don't do that. Don't do that." And I said, "Well, why not, Dad? You used to do that to us when we were quite young, and it made us feel good. Because I don't want you to do that. I don't want to remember all those things. I don't want to remember." And he started to cry. And he cried for a long time. And he got very embarrassed and wanted us all to leave the room. So my mother left, and my sister, who was there, left. And I said, "No, Dad, I'm not leaving the room. I need to do this because I need to remember this too." And he looked at me, and he stopped crying. And then he started crying again, and he felt good about it. And I got to touch his forehead.
How can I help you? How can I help you?
How can people, the healthiest way of grieving for people? That's one of the things.
See, I think that's the end of the question.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can grieve a loss is to acknowledge what the loss is. So if in the course of living, first of all, if we don't have a relationship, or if we can't label that relationship, but when it comes time to grieving, if you pardon the reiteration, we're at a loss. For instance, in most relationships, there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad. There's a lot of fond memories and there's a lot of very harsh memories. But when we think of a person that we're grieving, we don't separate those two. This is the person. This is the relationship we've had with this person. I can't grieve unless I can acknowledge the bad. I can't really let go unless I can let go of all parts of that.
Before my father was in the hospital in November of 1989, I needed to know what he thought about, what he wanted, because he was a private person and did not talk at all. I wanted to know about his early baseball career. He had told me things over the years about working down in Texas and the Stone Mountain Gap in West Virginia and the different teams that he played for at the AA and AAA level, and eventually playing for the Chicago White Sox and Washington Senators. But he told me about being in Brownsville, Texas. It was one of his great experiences with Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris in the early 50s, post-war, catching Hoyt Wilhelm's knuckleball and the golden arm of the great catcher that he was.
I am an honest man. I have a reputation in this town for being fair, my word, my handshake. I never had a contract in the business. If I said it was to be, it was to be. I pass this legacy on to you now.
Father Tony was a Catholic priest who worked at the hospital with the sick and the dying.
I have property, which I have worked hard for. I will pass it on to you, and you will pass it on to your sons and daughters.
He told me a story about a Jewish father and how he came to terms with his death and how he imparted it to his sons and to his wife with his property.
I pass on to you my philosophy of life, why I think I was born, why it is I am dying, where I have come from, what I think will become of me when I leave. I pass on to you, Mom. Be good to her. Take care of her. She is me. Tell the stories of my life. Make sure my memory will never, ever, ever die. As your sons will tell the story of your life. Then our ancestry may become live and real in each one of us.
When he was playing baseball down in Brownsville, Texas, he used to go across the border and go to the Catholic mission and take and receive communion. And it was a very powerful time in his life. And he felt very good about himself, I think, because he was able to continue his beliefs and the traditional Catholic beliefs that he held very strongly. And the Mass would be all in Spanish. And when I talked to him in November, he would tell me, he would give me the Hail Mary in Spanish. He didn't know it in English, I don't think. Ruega por nosotros pecadores. Ruega por nosotros pecadores. Ave Maria. And when I was at his hospital bed, when he was very, very sick, prior to being unconscious on morphine pumps, I said to him, Ruega por nosotros pecadores. Maybe that would trigger some emotional response, some memory, whatever it might have been. I needed him to say something to me about that so that I could understand what he might have gone through all those years. I didn't know. I needed to know. And he looked at me and goes, it's all shit. It's all a bunch of shit. I don't believe in any of it. Don't talk about that. I guess that was my cue to leave the room, because obviously I didn't know the password.
See, people die. Relationships don't die. And that is irrespective of anything anyone would personally choose to believe about an afterlife of this dying person. I could believe that there is no afterlife, that once you're dead, you're dead. And that doesn't take away from the notion that relationships don't die. I mean, I am the sum total of those significant relationships I have had, which I have integrated into my personality. That's who I am. That's why you and I are different, because we've had those different experiences.
He woke up the other day and looked at my mother and said, how much is this costing us? Oh, we've got Blue Cross. That's right. It'll take care of everything, right? And my mother, having prayers out to all corners of the country for him to be delivered into that good night, gently, if possible, wonders what's keeping him alive. Yesterday, he woke up and looked at my mother and said, we got to get all our clothes together and all our credit cards, and we'll get in the car and we'll just drive. And then more of the morphine kicked in, and he went back to sleep again.
Death, illness, strife, all they are is a gigantic magnifying glass held up to our demons, held up to those things that would hold us back. We live under the myth that we are in control. I can service my car, have the best tires, do the best everything. We live in a random world. I can get broadsided. We live in a random world. We need to make some sense out of nonsense, so we say it's God's will or something. I'm not sure my God would do that. We live in a random world.
The intervals of the morphine injection had to be every 8 minutes instead of every 12 minutes. That is how much pain that he was in. It was at that time I realized that that he was getting worse and that the time that he had left was probably not going to be that long.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For the heavens, the kingdom, the power, and the glory are yours, now and forever.
The need for the family right now is stronger than it ever has been. Because when someone dies, especially if it's your father,
may the peace of the Lord be with you all.
You might lose a certain direction in your life.
Let's show some sign of peace to each other.
Peace.
Peace.
Peace. Peace. Peace.
Enjoyed the Irish wake that we had for him. He would have sung Danny Boy.
And I loved him too, and I miss him.
He would have been embarrassed that people talked about him.
Now, this is sent to me. Peace and God's strength, it starts out. Today I read a notice on our board telling us of the resurrection of your dear husband. Somehow I feel sure that all heaven must have rushed out to meet him.
A friend of my father's had called the house and talked to my mother and did not know that my father had died. So my mother told her the bad news. The woman said to my mother,
she had this dream.
I had a dream
that he
about
came to
husband.
Her. She said he had a smile on his face, but he was calmly telling her the story about him being in the hospital and what he went through, this terrible time with cancer. And she said he had this aura around of white shining around his head. And she said, I woke up in a cold sweat, that I just had this compulsion that I had to call you right away that morning. She said, I was sad because he was dead, and I got that from it, but she said, he wasn't. And she said, I got this great sense of his being at peace.
Come and find the place where you are loved.
And towards the end, when he could barely breathe, he could barely get a breath out because he was in such pain, he would recite the Lord's Prayer and Hail Marys. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Pray for us now and at the hour of our death. Pray for us now and at the hour of our death. Over and over, the Hail Marys, the Lord's Prayer. And it was the last memories that I had of him.
Thank you.
sorry, you'll have to leave now. Visiting hours are over. But thanks for stopping by. It's always appreciated. There's a New Orleans jazz funeral up the street you might want to attend. Everyone's welcome. Brian Brophy's story about his father was produced by Barrett Golding. Brian Brophy is a theater director, a Fulbright lecturer to India at the Malviya Center for Peace Research, and a member of Tim Robbins' Actors Gang. You can find links to all the producers you heard this hour at hearingvoices.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Seal Muller.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.